There's a lot coming up. The Writers at Work next reading will be 1 week from tonight in this auditorium with a reading by Rick Bass. The Poetry Center is going to have the great pleasure of benefiting from a special reading on March 4th. Emmy Award actors Anthony Zerbe and Roscoe Lee Brown are going to do readings from great figures in American literature, T.S. Eliot and many others, and that will be at the Arizona Inn. That benefit is being arranged for the Poetry Center by Jill Francis, and she's going to be sending out a flyer soon. There's also another special that's coming to town. Florence Marshall, an actress who was the daughter in the original production of The Little Foxes in the 1930s, is coming to town to do a benefit for the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, and she's doing the Belle of Amherst. And that will be at the Unitarian Church on Friday, March the 9th. So I don't have enough copies of this newsletter to give to you, but if you didn't get one, you might give us a call if you'd like to be on our mailing list. We'll be happy to send things to you. We have a real treat tonight. Two super ladies are going to read for us. They're both here on the faculty of the Creative Writing Program. Vivian Gornick teaching in nonfiction, and Mary Elsie Robertson in fiction. Vivian Gornick's books of nonfiction are Fierce Attachments, a memoir, Women in Science, Portraits from World in Transition, Essays in Feminism, The Romance of American Communism, and In Search of Ali Mahmoud, an American Woman in Egypt. She co-edited with Barbara K. Moran, Women in Sexist Society, Studies in Power and Powerlessness. She was a staff writer on the Village Voice between 1969 and 77, and she's published over 200 articles, essays, and reviews for such publications as The Nation, New York Times, Washington Post, and The Atlantic. She recently served as a visiting professor. My tongue just goes by what it's used to. As a visiting professor at the University of Houston. It's a very great pleasure to introduce Vivian Gornick.
Hi. I'm going to read to you from Fierce Attachments. This is a memoir that I wrote about 2 years ago. It was published 2 years ago. And it's a story that I tell about my mother, myself, and a woman who lived next door to us when I was a child, or all the years I was growing up. When I set out to write Fierce Attachments, I thought the story was all in the past and that I would just write chronologically of what had happened then and bring us up to now. But I discovered, and the woman next door was dead, so she wouldn't be with us in the present. But I discovered along the way that I had a lot of unfinished business with my mother, which wouldn't lend itself readily to a story told in the past. And after a lot of agonizing and a lot of difficulty about how to solve what was essentially a writing problem, how was I going to put the two together, this ongoing struggle I had now in the present and this story of the past, I finally, after a lot of agonizing, hit on this. My mother and I walked all our lives together in the city of New York, where we both live, and I discovered one day, amusing myself in my troubles over not being able to get on with my book, that I told the story of a walk. I sat down and I wrote the story of a walk to myself at the typewriter. And I realized what I was doing, which was this. I was recounting the fact, essentially, that when my mother and I walk, she tells me stories from the past. And of course, she only has a certain store of stories, so she tells the same story over and over again. The thing that was different was every time she told the story, I'd be a few years older and I would ask another question. So her story remained the same, but my questions altered. And I understood then that that essentially was what I was doing here. I was asking the question of what had happened, and I would keep on asking it until I got the answers. So I devised this structure in which we walk in the present, and I tell the story of the past. And it goes back and forth. And about a third of the way through the book, I understood that eventually these two sets of women, those who are walking now and those who had lived then, would have to account for themselves to each other. And that is what I hope the book accomplished. So what I'm going to do is skip around. I tell you this only because I have chosen to skip around the book, but I'm going to follow that pattern. We're going to walk, and I'm going to tell you the story from the past. And it's not in chronological order as I wrote it, but you get the idea. I'm 8 years old. My mother and I come out of our apartment onto the second floor landing. Mrs. Drucker is standing in the open doorway of the apartment next door, smoking a cigarette. My mother locks the door and says to her, "What are you doing here?" Mrs. Drucker jerks her head backward toward her own apartment. "He wants to lay me. I told him he's got to take a shower before he can touch me." I know that he is her husband. He is always the husband. "Why, he's so dirty," my mother says. "He feels dirty to me," Mrs. Drucker says. "Drucker, you're a whore," my mother says. Mrs. Drucker shrugs her shoulder. "I can't ride the subways," she says. In the Bronx, ride the subway was a euphemism for going to work. I lived in that tenement between the ages of 6 and 21. There were 20 apartments, 4 to a floor, and all I remember is a building full of women. I hardly remember the men at all. They were everywhere, of course, husbands, fathers, brothers, but I remember only the women. And I remember them all crude like Mrs. Drucker or fierce like my mother. They never spoke as though they knew who they were, understood the bargain they had struck with life, but they often acted as though they knew. Shrewd, volatile, unlettered, they performed on a Dreiserian scale. There would be years of apparent calm, then suddenly an outbreak of panic and wildness. Two or three lives scarred, perhaps ruined, and the turmoil would subside. Once again, sullen quiet, erotic torpor, the ordinariness of daily denial. And I, the girl growing in their midst, being made in their image, I absorbed them as I would chloroform on a cloth laid against my face. It has taken me 30 years to understand how much of them I understood. My mother and I are out walking. I ask if she remembers the women in that building in the Bronx. "Of course," she replies. I tell her I've always thought sexual rage was what made them so crazy. "Absolutely," she says without breaking her stride. "Remember Drucker? She used to say if she didn't smoke a cigarette while she was having intercourse with her husband, she'd throw herself out the window. And Zimmerman, on the other side of us, they married her off to him when she was 16. She hated his guts. She used to say if he'd get killed on the job, he was a construction worker, it would be a mitzvah. That's Yiddish for blessing." My mother stops walking. Her voice drops in awe of her own memory. "He actually used to take her by physical force," she says, "would pick her up in the middle of the living room floor and carry her off to the bed." She stares into the middle distance for a moment. Then she says to me, "The European men, they were animals, just plain animals." She starts walking again. "Once Zimmerman locked him out of the house. He rang our bell. He could hardly look at me. He asked if he could use our fire escape window. I didn't speak one word to him. He walked through the house and climbed out the window." My mother laughs. "That fire escape window, it did some business. Remember Sessa upstairs? Oh, no, you couldn't remember her. She only lived there 1 year after we moved into the house. Then the Russians were in that apartment. Sessa and I were very friendly. It's so strange when I come to think of it. We hardly knew each other, any of us. Sometimes we didn't talk to each other at all, but we lived on top of one another. We were in and out of each other's houses. Everybody knew everything in no time at all. A few months in the building and the women were, well, intimate. This Sessa, she was a beautiful young woman, married only a few years. She didn't love her husband. She didn't hate him either. He was a nice man, actually. What can I tell you? She didn't love him. She used to go out every day. I think she had a lover somewhere. Anyway, she had long black hair down to her ass. One day she cut it off. She wanted to be modern. Her husband didn't say anything to her. But her father came into the house, took one look at her cut hair, gave her a slap across the face. She saw her grandmother from the next world. Then he instructed her husband to lock her in the house for a month. She used to come down the fire escape into my window and out my door every afternoon for a month. One day she comes back and we're having coffee in the kitchen. I say to her, Sessa, tell your father this is America, Sessa, America. You're a free woman. She looks at me and she says to me, what do you mean tell my father this is America? He was born in Brooklyn. My relationship with my mother is not good, and as our lives accumulate, it often seems to worsen. We are locked into a narrow channel of acquaintance, intense and binding. For years at a time, there is an exhaustion, a kind of softening between us. Then the rage comes up again, hot and clear, erotic in its power to compel attention. These days, it is bad between us. My mother's way of dealing with the bad times is to accuse me loudly and publicly of the truth. Whenever she sees me, she says, you hate me. I know you hate me. I'll be visiting her, and she'll say to anyone who happens to be in the room, a neighbor, a friend, my brother, one of my nieces, she hates me. What she has against me, I don't know, but she hates me. She is equally capable of stopping a stranger on the street when we're out walking and saying, this is my daughter. She hates me. Then she'll turn to me and plead, what did I do to you? You should hate me so. I never answer. I know she's burning, and I'm glad to let her burn. Why not? I'm burning too. But we walk the streets of New York together endlessly. We both live in Lower Manhattan now, our apartments a mile apart, and we visit best by walking. My mother is an urban peasant, and I am my mother's daughter. The city is our natural element. We each have daily adventures with bus drivers, bag ladies, ticket takers, and street crazies. Walking brings out the best in us. I am 45 now, and my mother is 77. Her body is strong and healthy. She traverses the island easily with me. We don't love each other on these walks. Often we are raging at each other, but we walk anyway. Our best times together are when we speak of the past. I'll say to her, Ma, remember Mrs. Kornfeld? Tell me that story again. And she'll delight in telling me the story again. It is only the present she hates. As soon as the present becomes the past, she immediately begins loving it. Each time she tells the story, it is both the same and different, because each time I'm older, and it occurs to me to ask a question I didn't ask the last time around. The Bronx was a patchwork of invaded ethnic territories, four or five square blocks dominated by Irish or Italians or Jews, but each section with its quota of Irish living in a Jewish block or Jews in an Italian block. Much has been made of this change rung on the New York neighborhood register, but those who grew up running the Irish or Italian gauntlet or being frozen out by Jewish neighbors are not nearly so marked by their extra portion of outsidedness as they are leveled by the shared street life. Our family had lived for a year in an Italian neighborhood. My brother and I had been the only Jewish children in the school, and we had indeed been miserable. That's all, miserable. When we moved back into a Jewish neighborhood, my brother was relieved at no longer having to worry that he'd be beaten up every afternoon by kids who called him the Jewish genius. But the outline and substance of his life were not fundamentally altered. The larger truth is that the otherness of the Italians or the Irish or the Jews among us lent spice and interest, a sense of definition, an exciting edge to things that was openly feared but secretly welcomed. Our building was all Jewish, except for the one Irish family on the first floor, one Russian family on the third floor, and a Polish superintendent. The Russians were tall and silent. They came and went in the building in a manner that seemed mysterious. The Irish were all thin and blonde, blue eyes, narrow lips, closed faces. They, too, were a shadowy presence among us. The super and his wife were also quiet. They never spoke first to anyone. That's the main thing, I guess, about being a few among the many. It silences you. My mother might have been silenced, too, had she remained living among the Italians, might have snatched her children up in wordless anxiety when a neighbor befriended one of us, just as Mrs. Cassidy did whenever a woman in our building smoothed the hair of one of the Irish blondies. But my mother was not one among the many. Here in this all-Jewish building, she was in her element, had enough room between the skin of social presence and the flesh of an unknowing center in which to move around, express herself freely, be warm and sarcastic, hysterical and generous, ironic and judgmental, and occasionally what she thought of as affectionate, that rough bullying style she assumed when overcome with the tenderness she most feared. My mother was distinguished in the building by her unaccented English and the certainty of her manner. Although our apartment door was always closed, a distinction was made between those educated enough to value the privacy of a closed door and those so peasant-like the door was always half open. The neighbors felt free to knock at any time, borrow small kitchen necessities, share a piece of building gossip, even asked my mother to act as arbiter in an occasional quarrel. Her manner at such times was that of a superior person embarrassed by the childlike behavior of her inferiors. "Oi, Zimmerman," she would smile patronizingly when Mrs. Zimmerman, beside herself over some slight, real or imagined, came to tell her of the perfidy of one or another of our neighbors. "Such foolishness," or, "That's ridiculous," she would rap out sharply when a tale she considered base or ignorant was repeated to her. She seemed never to be troubled by the notion that there might be two sides to a story or more than one interpretation of an event. She knew that compared with the women around her, she was developed, a person of higher thought and feeling. So what was there to think about? Developed was one of her favorite words. If Mrs. Zimmerman spoke loudly in the hall on a Saturday morning, we, sitting in the kitchen just behind our apartment door, would stare at each other, and inevitably, my mother would shake her head and pronounce an undeveloped woman. If someone made a crack about the Schwarzes, that's Yiddish for blacks, my mother would carefully explain to me that such sentiments were undeveloped. If there was a dispute in the grocery store over price or weight, again, I would hear the word undeveloped. My father smiled at her when she said undeveloped, whether out of indulgence or pride, I never did know. My brother, on his guard from the age of 10, stared without expression. But I absorbed the feel of her words, soaked up every accompanying gesture and expression, every complicated bit of impulse and intent. Mama thinking everyone around was undeveloped and most of what they said was ridiculous became imprinted on me like dye on the most receptive of materials. We're walking up Fifth Avenue. It's a bad day for me. I'm feeling fat and lonely, trapped in my lousy life. I know I should be home working and that I'm here playing the dutiful daughter only to avoid the desk. The anxiety is so great I'm walking with a stomach ache. My mother, as always, knows she can do nothing for me, but my unhappiness makes her nervous. She is talking at tedious, obfuscating length about a cousin of mine who was considering divorce. As we near the library, an Eastern religionist, shaved head, translucent skin, a bag of bones wrapped in faded pink gauze, darts at us, a copy of his leader's writings extended in his hand. My mother keeps talking while the creature in gauze flaps around us, his spiel a steady buzz in the air, competing for my attention. At last she feels interrupted. She turns to him. "What is it?" she says. "What do you want from me? Tell me." He tells her. She hears him out. Then she straightens her shoulders, draws herself up to her full 5 feet 2 inches, and announces, "Young man, I am a Jew and a socialist. I think that's more than enough for one lifetime, don't you?" The pink-gowned boy man is charmed and for a moment bemused. "My parents are Jews," he confides, "but they certainly aren't socialists." My mother stares at him, shakes her head, grasps my arm firmly in her fingers, and marches me off up the avenue. "Can you believe this?" she says. "A nice Jewish boy shaves his head and babbles in the street. A world full of crazies. Divorce everywhere, and if not divorce, this. What a generation you all are." "Don't start, Ma," I say. "I don't want to hear that bullshit again." "Bullshit here, bullshit there," she says. "It's still true. Whatever else we did, we didn't fall apart in the streets like you're all doing. We had order, quiet, dignity. Families stayed together and people lived decent lives." That's a crock. They didn't lead decent lives. They lived hidden lives. "You're not going to tell me people were happier then, are you?" "No," she capitulates instantly. "I'm not saying that." "Well, what are you saying?" She frowns and stops talking, searches around in her head to find out what she is saying. Ah, she's got it. Triumphant, accusing, she says, "The unhappiness is so alive today." Her words startle and gratify me. I feel pleasure when she says a true or a clever thing. I come close to loving her. "That's the first step," Ma, I say softly. "The unhappiness has to be made alive before anything can happen." She stops in front of the library. She doesn't want to hear what I'm saying, but she's excited by the exchange. Her faded brown eyes, dark and brilliant in my childhood, brighten as the meaning of her words and mine penetrates her thought. Her cheeks flush, and her pudding soft face hardens wonderfully with new definition. She looks beautiful to me. I know from experience she will remember this afternoon as a deeply pleasurable one. I also know she will not be able to tell anyone why it has been pleasurable. She enjoys thinking, only she doesn't know it. She has never known it. A year after my mother told Mrs. Drucker she was a whore, the Druckers moved out of the building and Nettie Levine moved into their vacated apartment. I have no memory of the Druckers moving out or of Nettie moving in, no truck or moving van coming to take away or deposit the furniture, dishes, or clothes of the one or the other. People and all their belongings seemed to evaporate out of an apartment, and others simply took their place. How early I absorbed the circumstantial nature of most attachments. After all, what difference did it really make if we called the next-door neighbor Roseman or Drucker or Zimmerman? It mattered only that there was a next-door neighbor. Nettie, however, would make a difference. I was running down the stairs after school, rushing to get out on the street, when we collided in the darkened hallway. The brown paper bags in her arms went flying in all directions. We each said, "Oh," and stepped back, I against the staircase railing, she against the paint-blistered wall. I bent, blushing, to help her retrieve the bags scattered across the landing, and saw that she had bright red hair piled high on her head in a pompadour and streaming down her back and over her shoulders. Her features were narrow and pointed, the eyes almond-shaped, the mouth and nose thin and sharp, and her shoulders were wide, but she was slim. She reminded me of the pictures of Greta Garbo. My heart began to pound. I had never before seen a beautiful woman. "Don't worry about the packages," she said. "Go out and play. The sun is shining. You mustn't waste it here in the dark. Go, go." Her English was accented like the English of the other women in the building, but her voice was soft, almost musical, and her words took me by surprise. My mother had never urged me not to lose pleasure, even if it was only the pleasure of the sunny street. I ran down the staircase, excited. I knew she was the new neighbor. "A Ukrainian redhead married to a Jew," my mother had remarked dryly. only 2 or 3 days before seemed impossible. Everything about Nettie proved to be impossible. She was a Gentile married to a Jew like no Jew we had ever known. Her husband was in the Merchant Marines. It was during the middle of the Second World War. And no Jew was in the Merchant Marines, as everybody knew, but he was. Alone most of the time and apparently free to live wherever she chose, she had chosen to live in among working-class Jews who offered her neither goods nor charity. A woman whose sexy good looks brought her darting glances of envy and curiosity, she seemed to value inordinately the life of every respectable dowd. She praised my mother lavishly for her housewifely skills, her ability to make small wages go far, always have the house smelling nice and the children content to be at home. As though these skills were a treasure, some precious dowry that had been denied her and symbolized a life from which she had been shut out. My mother, secretly as amazed as everyone else by Nettie's allure, would look thoughtfully at her when she tried, often vaguely, incoherently, to speak of the differences between them, and would say to her, "But you're a wife now. You'll learn these things. It's nothing. There's nothing to learn." Nettie's face would then flush painfully, and she'd shake her head. My mother didn't understand, and she couldn't explain. Rick Levine returned to New York 2 months after Nettie had moved into the building. She was wildly proud of her tall, dark, bearded semen, showing him off in the street to the teenagers she had made friends with, dragging him in to meet us, making him go to the grocery store with her. And she became visibly transformed. A kind of illumination settled on her skin. Her green almond eyes were speckled with light. A new grace touched her movements. The way she walked, moved her hands, smoothed back her hair. There was suddenly about her an aristocracy of physical being. Her beauty deepened. She was untouchable. I saw the change in her and was magnetized. I would wake up in the morning and wonder if I was going to run into her in the hall that day. If I didn't, I'd find an excuse to ring her bell. It wasn't that I wanted to see her with Rick. His was a sullen beauty, glum and lumpish, and there was nothing happening between them that interested me. It was her I wanted to see, only her, and I wanted to touch her. My hand was always threatening to shoot away from my body, out toward her face, her arm, her side. I yearned toward her. She radiated a kind of promise I couldn't stay away from. I wanted, I didn't know what I wanted. But the elation was short-lived, hers and mine. One morning, a week after Rick's return, my mother ran into Nettie as they were both leaving the house. Nettie turned away from her. "What's wrong?" my mother demanded. "Turn around. Let me see your face." Nettie turned toward her slowly. A tremendous blue-black splotch surrounded her half-closed right eye. "Oh, my God," my mother breathed reverently. "He didn't mean it," Nettie pleaded. "It was a mistake. He wanted to go down to the bar to see his friends. I wouldn't let him go. It took a long time before he hit me." After that, she looked again as she had before he came home. 2 weeks later, Rick Levine was gone again, this time on a 4-month cruise. He swore to his clinging wife that this would be his last trip. When he came home in April, he said he'd find a good job in this city and they would at long last settle down. She believed that he meant it this time, and finally she let him pull her arms from around his neck. 6 weeks after he had sailed, she discovered she was pregnant. Late in the 3rd month of his absence, she received a telegram informing her that Rick had been shot to death during a quarrel in a bar in port somewhere on the Baltic Sea. His body was being shipped back to New York, and the insurance was in question. Nettie became intertwined in the dailiness of our life so quickly it was hard later for me to remember what our days had been like before she lived next door. She'd slip in for coffee late in the morning, then again in the afternoon, and seemed to have supper with us 3 nights a week. Soon I felt free to walk into her house at any hour, and my brother was being consulted daily about the puzzling matter of Rick's insurance. "It's a pity on her," my mother kept saying. "A widow, pregnant, poor, abandoned." Actually, her unexpected widowhood made Nettie safely pathetic and safely other. It was as though she had been trying long before her husband died to let my mother know that she was disenfranchised in a way Mama could never be. perched only temporarily on a landscape Mama was entrenched in. And when Rick obligingly got himself killed, this deeper truth became apparent. My mother could now sustain Nettie's beauty without becoming unbalanced, and Nettie could help herself to Mama's respectability without being humbled. The compact was made without a word between them. We got beautiful Nettie in the kitchen every day, and Nettie got my mother's protection in the building. When Mrs. Zimmerman rang our bell to inquire snidely after the shiksa, my mother cut her off sharply, telling her she was busy and had no time to talk nonsense. After that, no one in the building gossiped about Nettie in front of any of us. It rained earlier in the day, and now at 1 p.m, for a minute and a half, New York is washed clean. The streets glitter in the pale spring sunlight. Cars radiate dust-free happiness. Storefront windows sparkle mindlessly. Even people look made anew. We're walking down 8th Avenue into the village. At the corner of 8th and Greenwich is a White Tower hamburger joint where a group of derelicts in permanent residence entertain visiting out-of-towners from 14th Street, Chelsea, even the Bowery. This afternoon, the party on the corner, often raucous, is definitely on the gloomy side, untouched by weather renewal. As we pass the restaurant doors, however, one gentleman detaches from the group, takes two or three uncertain steps, and bars our way. He stands swaying before us. He is black, somewhere between 25 and 60. His face is cut and swollen, the eyelids three-quarters shut. His hair is 100 filthy, matted little pigtails. His pants are held up by a piece of rope. His shoes are two sizes too large, the feet inside them bare. So is his chest, visible beneath a grimy tweed coat that swings open whenever he moves. This creature confronts us, puts out his hand, palm up, and speaks. "Can you ladies let me have $1,000 for a martini?" he inquires. My mother looks directly into his face. "I know we're in an inflation," she says, "but $1,000 for a martini?" His mouth drops. It's the first time in God knows how long that a mark has acknowledged his existence. "You're beautiful," he burbles at her, "beautiful." "Look on him," she says to me in Yiddish. "Just look on him." He turns his bleary eyelids in my direction. "What'd she say?" he demands. "What'd she say?" "She said you're breaking her heart," I tell him. "She say that?" His eyes nearly open. "She say that?" I nod. He whirls at her. "Take me home and make love to me," he croons. And right there in the street in the middle of the day, he begins to bay at the moon. "I need you," he howls at my mother and doubles over, his fist in his stomach. "I need you." She nods at him. "I need too," she says dryly. "Fortunately or unfortunately, it is not you I need." And she propels me around the now motionless derelict. Paralyzed by recognition, he will no longer bar our progress down the street. We cross Abingdon Square and walk into Bleecker Street. The gentrified West Village closes around us, makes us not peaceful, but quiet. We walk through block after block of antique stores, gourmet shops, boutiques, not speaking. But for how long can my mother and I not speak? "So I'm reading the biography you gave me," she says. I look at her puzzled, and then I remember. Oh, I smile in wide delight. "Are you enjoying it?" "Listen," she begins. The smile drops off my face and my stomach contracts. That "listen" means she's about to trash the book I gave her to read. She's going to say, "What? What's here? What's here that I don't already know? I lived through it. I know it all. What can this writer tell me that I don't already know? Nothing. To you, it's interesting, but to me, how can this be interesting to me?" On and on she'll go, the way she does, when she thinks she doesn't understand something, and she's scared, and she's taking refuge in scorn and hypocriticality. The book I gave her to read is a biography of Josephine Herbst, a 30s writer, a stubborn, willful, raging woman grabbing at politics and love and writing, in there punching until the last minute. Listen, my mother says now in the patronizing tone she thinks conciliatory. Maybe this is interesting to you, but not to me. I lived through all this. I know it all. What can I learn from this? Nothing. To you, it's interesting, not to me. Invariably, when she speaks so, my head fills with blood, and before the sentences have stopped pouring from her mouth, I am lashing out at her. You're an ignoramus. You know nothing. Only a know-nothing talks the way you do. The point of having lived through it, as you say, is only that the background is familiar, so the book is made richer. Not that you could have written the book. People 1,000 times more educated than you have read and learned from this book, but you can't learn from it? On and on I would go, thoroughly ruining the afternoon for both of us. However, in the past year, an odd circumstance has begun to obtain. On occasion, my head fails to fill with blood. I become irritated but remain calm. Not falling into a rage, I do not make a holocaust of the afternoon. Today, it appears one of those moments is upon us. I turn to my mother, throw my left arm round her still solid back, place my right hand on her upper arm and say, Ma, if this book is not interesting to you, that's fine. You can say that. She looks coyly at me, eyes large, head half turned. Now she's interested. But don't say it has nothing to teach you, that there's nothing here. That's unworthy of you and the book and me. You demean us all when you say that. Listen to me, such wisdom, and all of it gained 10 minutes ago. Silence, long silence. We walk another block, silence. She's looking off into that middle distance. I take my lead from her, matching my steps to hers. I do not speak, do not press her. Another silent block. That Josephine Herbst, my mother says. She certainly carried on, didn't she? Relieved and happy, I hug her. She didn't know what she was doing either, Ma, but yeah, she carried on. I'm jealous, my mother blurts at me. I'm jealous. She lived her life. I didn't live mine. Mama and Nettie quarreled, and I entered City College. In feeling memory, these events carry equal weight. Both inaugurated open conflict. Both drove a wedge between me and the unknowing self. Both were experienced as subversive and warlike in character. Certainly the conflict between Nettie and my mother seemed a strategic plan to surround and conquer. Incoherent as the war was, shot through with rage and deceit, its aims apparently confused and always denied, it never lost sight of the enemy, the intelligent heart of the girl who, if not bonded to one, would be lost to both. City College as well seemed no less concerned with laying siege to the ignorant mind, if not the intelligent heart. Benign in intent, only a passport to the promised land, City, of course, was the real invader. It did more violence to the emotions than either Mama or Nettie could have dreamed possible, divided me from them both, provoked and nourished an unshared life inside the head that became a piece of treason. I lived among my people, but I was no longer one of them. I think this was true for most of us at City College. We still use the subways, still walk the familiar streets between classes, still return to the neighborhood each night, talk to our high school friends, and went to sleep in our own beds. But secretly, we had begun to live in a world inside our heads where we read, talked, thought in a way that separated us from our parents, the life of the house, and that of the street. We had been initiated, had learned the difference between hidden and expressed thought. This made us subversives in our own homes. As thousands before me have said, for us it was City College or nothing. I enjoyed the solidarity those words invoked, but rejected the implied deprivation. At City College, I sat talking in a basement cafeteria until 10 or 11 at night with a half dozen others who also never wanted to go home, to Brooklyn or the Bronx, and here in the cafeteria, my education took root. Here I learned that Faulkner was America, Dickens was politics, Marx was sex, Jane Austen the idea of culture, that I came from a ghetto and D.H. Lawrence was a visionary. Here my love of literature named itself and amazement over the life of the mind blossomed. I discovered that people were transformed by ideas and that intellectual conversation was immensely erotic. We never stopped talking, perhaps because we did very little else. Restricted by sexual fear and working class economics, we didn't go to the theater and we didn't make love. But certainly we talked so much because most of us had been reading in bottled up silence from the age of six on. And City College was our great release. It was not from the faculty that City drew its reputation for intellectual goodness. It was from its students. It was from us. Not that we were intellectually distinguished. We weren't. But our hungry energy vitalized the place. The idea of intellectual life burned in us. While we pursued ideas, we felt known to ourselves and to one another. The world made sense. There was ground beneath our feet, a place in the universe to stand. City College made conscious in me inner cohesion as a first value. I think my mother was very quickly of two minds about me and City, although she had wanted me to go to school, no question about that, had been energized by the determination that I do so, instructed me in the middle of her first year of widowhood to enter the academic, not the commercial course of high school study, and was even embattled when it became something of an issue in the family. "Where is it written that a working-class widow's daughter should go to college?" one of my uncles said to her, drinking coffee at our kitchen table on a Saturday morning in my senior year in high school. "Here it is written," she had replied, tapping the table hard with her middle finger. "Right here it is written, the girl goes to college." "Why?" he had pursued. "Because I say so." "But why? What do you think will come of it?" "I don't know. I only know she's clever, she deserves an education, and she's going to get one. This is America. The girls are not cows in the field only waiting for a bull to mate with." I stared at her. Where had that come from? The moment was filled with conflict and bravado. She felt the words she spoke, but she did not mean them. She didn't even know what she meant by an education. When she discovered at my graduation that I wasn't a teacher, she acted as though she'd been swindled. In her mind, a girl child went in one door marked college and came out another marked teacher. "You mean you're not a teacher?" she said to me, eyes widening as her two strong hands held my diploma down on the kitchen table. "No," I said. "What have you been doing there all these years?" she asked quietly. "Reading novels," I replied. She marveled silently at my chutzpah. But it wasn't really a matter of what I could or could not do with the degree. We were people who knew how to stay alive. She never doubted I would find a way. No, what drove her and divided us was me thinking. She hadn't understood that going to school meant I would start thinking, coherently and out loud. She was taken by violent surprise. My sentences got longer within a month of those first classes. Longer, more complicated, formed by words whose meanings she did not always know. I had never before spoken a word she didn't know. Or made a sentence whose logic she couldn't follow, or attempted an opinion that grew out of an abstraction. It made her crazy. Her face began to take on a look of animal cunning when I started a sentence that could not possibly be concluded before three clauses had hit the air. Cunning sparked anger. Anger flamed into rage. "What are you talking about?" she would shout at me. "What are you talking about? Speak English, please. We all understand English in this house. Speak it." Her response stunned me. I didn't get it. Wasn't she pleased that I could say something she didn't understand? Wasn't that what it was all about? I was the advance guard. I was going to take her into the new world. All she had to do was adore what I was becoming. And here she was refusing. I'd speak my new sentences, and she would turn on me as though I'd performed a vile act right there at the kitchen table. She, of course, was as confused as I. She didn't know why she was angry, and if she'd been told she was angry, she would have denied it, would have found a way to persuade both herself and any interested listener that she was proud I was in school. Only why did I have to be such a show-off? Was that what going to college was all about? Now take Mr. Lewis, the insurance agent, an educated man if ever there was one, got a degree from City College in 1929, mind you, and never made you feel stupid, always spoke in simple sentences, but later you thought about what he had said. That's the way an educated person should talk. Here's this snot-nosed kid coming into the kitchen with all these big words, sentences you can't make head or tail of. I was 17, she was 50. I had not yet come into my own as a qualifying belligerent, but I was a respectable contender, and she naturally was at the top of her game. The lines were drawn, and we did not fail one another. Each of us rose repeatedly to the bait the other one tossed out. Our storms shook the apartment. Paint blistered on the wall. Linoleum cracked on the floor. Glass shivered in the window frame. We barely kept our hands off one another, and more than once we approached disaster. One Saturday afternoon, she was lying on the couch. I was reading in a nearby chair. Idly, she asked, "What are you reading?" Idly, I replied, "A comparative history of the idea of love over the last 300 years. She looked at me for a moment. "That's ridiculous," she said slowly. "Love is love. It's the same everywhere. What's to compare?" "That's absolutely not true," I shot back. "You don't know what you're talking about. It's only an idea, Ma. That's all love is, just an idea. You think it's a function of the mysterious immutable being, but it's not. There is, in fact, no such thing as the mysterious immutable being." Her legs were off the couch so fast I didn't see them go down. She made fists of her hands, closed her eyes tight, and howled, "I'll kill you, snake in my bosom, I'll kill you. How dare you talk to me that way?" And then she was coming at me. She was small and chunky, so was I, but I had 30 years on her. I was out of the chair faster than her arm could make contact and running through the apartment, racing for the bathroom, the only room with a lock on it. The top half of the bathroom door was a panel of frosted glass. She arrived just as I turned the lock and couldn't put the brakes on. She drove her fist through the glass, reaching for me. Blood, screams, shattered glass on both sides of the door. I thought that afternoon, one of us is going to die of this attachment. Thank you. Thank you.